it's just impressive, like I said, looking at side-by-side varieties with one, you know, variety that's just 90-95% of the leaf area is covered with rust, and the other one has maybe, you know, two or three specks on it. It's just amazing to see the genetic differences there.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Mark Licht, Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist at Iowa State University. Please subscribe to our channel to receive notifications of new episodes. Today, we're going to talk with Brandon Garish. He's an assistant professor and Texas A&M AgriLife Extension State Small Grain Specialist. A little bit of a tongue twister for me there. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
So let's start right off just by having you kind of give maybe a little bit more of a broad introduction, you know, maybe talking about your career path. And, you know, I did notice that you started off in Texas A&M, you left and went to Washington State University, and now you're back at Texas A&M. So you'll have to explain how that happened.
Yeah, so I'm actually originally born and raised in the state of Maine and came down to Texas A&M. Went on, did my master's with Dr. Amir Ibrahim. So I was actually did my master's in plant breeding, working on hybrid wheat. And that was really my first introduction to really working with wheat at any in any capacity. And so that's what really gauged my interest in small grains. During that time frame, I worked with the former state specialist, Clark Neely. And so when I finished my master's, I went on to do a PhD in the program that I'm leading now. So that's how I got more inclined to extension work. And so at one point, when I was doing my master's, I was fairly certain I would do a, you know, plant breeding type job. But really, when I got to know extension better, being able to work with farmers and seed companies, kind of the whole conglomeration that goes into that, that's what I really enjoyed doing. And so when I graduated, I went and worked at the cereal variety testing program in Washington State for Washington State University. And I was there for just under 4 years. And one day I got a call from the administration saying, asking if I would be interested in applying for this position when it came open. And so I applied for that and started here in this position in September of 23.
Okay. Wow. Nice little journey. And I recognize some of the names of the people you've worked with. And you've got some good tutelage as you've came through this the process. So it's always fun to hear those stories and learn.
Imagine if every acre could grow more than one crop, your row crop above ground and a carbon crop below it. Loam Bio helps American farmers grow and harvest that below ground crop using their world first carbon stabilizing biotechnology within a soil carbon project. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
So let's kind of jump in and think about small grains production in Texas. What does that landscape look like? What small grain species are you really working with? And I guess maybe even, you know, for the listeners, you know, talk a little bit about how many acres and where those acres are at.
Yeah, so it's Texas is an interesting state to work with small grains, especially in comparison to a lot of other states across the nation, especially Washington State, where Washington, you know, wheat is grown, you know, wheat is kind of king in that state, and it's all for grain yield. In Texas, we have a lot more species that we work with. So wheat is definitely the predominant one that we work with, and it's grown pretty well across the majority of the state in one capacity or the other. But there's several classifications that we work with. So hard red winter wheat being the main one. Then we do have a fair deal of soft red winter wheat, and that's primarily located in the Northeast region, kind of Dallas-Fort Worth, and a little bit south from there. And then in deep South Texas, so kind of south of San Antonio, maybe, you know, south of Houston, you run into some hard red spring wheat. So a little bit there. And then there's some specialty markets for things like hard white wheat. A lot of the organic growers that we work with actually are interested in growing hard white wheat. And so we do see some hard white wheats show up in our variety trials. And so on a year-to-year basis, it can fluctuate, but we're somewhere between 5 and 5.5 million acres of wheat grown in the state. And so one of the probably higher amounts of any state that we, you know, planted acres. Probably 40-45% of that is going to be located in the Texas High Plains, so the Texas Panhandle, especially around Amarillo, kind of a little bit south and north of that. Another 40-45% is going to be grown in the Texas Rolling Plains, so in the Wichita Falls to Vernon area, south down to San Angelo, Brady area. And then probably 8% or so is going to be grown in the Texas Blacklands, so kind of that area from Dallas-Fort Worth down to Waco. In that strip, we have a pretty good pocket of wheat. And then that only leaves, you know, 2-3% really that's grown in the South Texas region.
So it's largely wheat that you're dealing with, not like rye or barleys or anything like that.
So I work with a lot of other small grains in a forage capacity. And so we work a lot with oats for forage and I would say oat and triticale are the two, probably the next two biggest ones. But we also work with a little bit of barley, a little bit of rye. And so we have quite a bit that goes into the capacity, but not typically for grain yield. It's all for forage production. And the real reason for that is, you know, if you look at some of the estimates, you know, from some of the USDA surveys and things like that, we can grow up to 300,000 acres of oats in the state, but only about 10% of that is actually grown for seed or grain production. The rest of it is really grown for forage production. And we're even seeing a large shift. I mean, wheat has always been, you know, in Texas, a big thing to graze, you know, for the beef cattle industry. There are some estimates I've heard that about 50% of the wheat in the state can be grazed or used for forage each year. And so forage is really a big element to that. And with the rise of the Texas dairy industry, wheat lidge, especially in the Texas Panhandle, is becoming a bigger deal as well.
That's interesting. A lot of times when we think about, you know, small grains, wheat, rye, triticale, oats, a lot of times we do think about it from a grain production standpoint. But you're indicating that there's, you know, quite a bit from a forage livestock feed, you know, perspective as well.
Yes, and it really is. It's especially centered around some of the dairies. You get north of Amarillo, kind of in that Hartley area. There's some, I mean, I was impressed. I had never seen them before until about 2 years ago. And there are some impressive dairies in that area. And we actually have trouble in some of those areas finding places to put grain variety trials because almost all of the wheat is being harvested early for silage. And so the growers don't want to have a little spot in the middle of the field that's just left for grain production. So that's actually played a part in some of the variety testing that we do because we have to shift where we can put those trials to where, you know, where they're needed or where we can find, you know, a spot to put them. And so that really does play a big part in the wheat landscape of Texas and small grains in general.
So you mentioned you do the variety trials. Is that mostly on the grain side, or do you also do some of the variety trials from a forage quality standpoint as well?
Yeah, so we conduct three different types of trials. So the first one is going to be a grain-only type trial. And so those are going to be your typical variety trials where we're planting them out, we're letting them grow for grain, and then we are, you know, harvesting them for grain. And we're looking at things like test weight and grain protein and those types of trials in addition to yield. The next type of trial we do is a simulated forage grazing trial. And so those are multi-species, and that's really where I get into the other species of small grains. And so we're comparing wheat, barley, oats, triticale all into one trial, and we're taking forage clippings. We typically shoot for three times per year. So I have a forage harvester, and we're cutting all that forage off. It looks, you know, it's pretty impressive looking, because when we get into the field, it's all varying heights and everything like that, you know, based on the variety and the species. And when we get done, it looks like a freshly mowed lawn. But we're collecting all that biomass, and the machine weighs it. And so we can then, you know, take some subsamples and dry them out and actually get a dry matter production per acre on those and do comparisons for forage yield, multi-species. And then finally, one thing that I've really been trying to increase our research into is dual-purpose production, because as I mentioned, we have a lot of grazed wheat that is potentially used in a dual purpose production, meaning they're going to graze it before that wheat jointing. They're going to pull the cattle off and they're going to let it go for grain. And so with those, we're doing kind of a hybrid approach between those two other trials, where we're trying to take one or two clippings prior to jointing to get that estimated biomass yield, and then letting it go to grain and taking those grain yields.
That's an interesting prospect. I suppose you have to be careful, you know, especially if it's more from a grazing perspective, you know, looking at, you know, really the cattle and the impact that the cattle have on the plant stand and health as well.
And that's one thing that hopefully in time we'll be able to do a little bit better. Right now, we don't really have a good capacity. You know, doing trials with actual animals is a little more, you know, quite a bit more difficult, a little bit more expensive. But you're exactly right. There's certainly probably some differences in the way the varieties handle, you know, just general trampling, you know, as the cattle are out there, or how they feed, more so than what we can probably detect in our trials as well.
So are there certain variety types that, you know, that really lend themselves to this dual purpose production system? Or do you really look for what I would, you know, maybe term as more like the high yielding grain types and just get the forage value that you can off of them?
I think, you know, we've done these trials for a number of years, but more to a limited extent than what we're trying to do this year, especially. Before, we've kind of had a separate entry, you know, for dual purpose, and we wouldn't get all of the varieties in there. And in the past, a lot of times we may try to say that a variety is a good dual purpose crop because it did really well in our forage trials and it did really well in our grain trials. But those don't, you know, some varieties, I don't think what we will see necessarily, it doesn't necessarily equate. Some varieties aren't, once they get clipped, aren't going to grow back as good as potentially others. So I think there's definitely going to be a varietal effect in that. And something that we shifted to this year is just one entry. So anybody that enters into our grain trials, it automatically gets entered into our dual purpose trials. So that way we can test, instead of having kind of a limited set, we are getting to test everything into that, and really hopefully get some good data on varietal differences there.
A little bit of value added for the companies that are entering in varieties.
Hopefully so. Hopefully they find that. So,
how many entries do you typically have in the variety trials, and how many locations do you do the variety trials at?
So we will do just over 30 locations across the state. So my program, I coordinate all the trials. So I coordinate all the entries coming in, the seed packaging. But I do work with a number of extension agronomists and breeders around the state who also help to manage, you know, implement and manage those trials. So my program implements a little less than half of those direct management, but I do all the data analysis and all the coordination of the trials statewide. So we have 30 some odd locations and probably around 60 trials total, because, you know, at a few sites we have the forage, dual purpose, and grain only at the same location. For a number of varieties, it really depends on the where in the state we are. So in the high plains, we're typically somewhere between 40 and 48-ish this year. I think we're at 44 and 48, depending on we split our dry land and irrigated into two different entries. In the rolling plains, it's just dry land. We have 50 this year, so a pretty full trial. I'd kind of like to keep it at 50. And then the blacklands, we're at about 30 this year. That's kind of a unique area. It maybe doesn't get the recognition it deserves for being a grain, you know, a wheat producing area. Something that's unique about the blacklands, I think, is that it doesn't get quite the grazing. It's not known as a grazing part of the state. So anything that's really grown in that blackland region is probably being grown for grain production rather than a forage production, just in general. And then in South Texas, as I mentioned, it's a pretty low percentage of the wheat acres in the state. So we only have about 20.
Wow. That's a, you know, by the time you think of the number of entries and the number of locations, that's a lot of data to start managing. Are you able to kind of pull out and look at some of the entries across those locations and start to develop patterns?
Yes. It's somewhat, you know, Texas is just so large. It leads to a lot of diversity in the state. And so things that are really an issue in one part of the state, growers in the other part of the state never even see it. You know, varieties, we have a few varieties that are really susceptible to like leaf rust, and you put them in South Texas or the Blacklands, and boy, they're going to struggle unless you're putting fungicide on them. You put them in the high, you know, dry land, high plains trial. How often do they see any leaf rust up there to a measurable amount? Kind of the same thing in the Texas high plains. And this last year up through Kansas and Oklahoma, wheat streak mosaic virus was a really big deal. That's nothing we ever see down here in South Texas. So it's unusual to see a variety that can, you know, as I mentioned, we kind of break our state into those four mega environments when we do our testing. And it's unusual to see a variety that can transcend all four regions and do near the top in all four, just because of how diverse there is in disease or insect, rainfall, just general growing conditions.
Yeah. You mentioned having irrigated acres or trials under irrigation. Is that a common practice? Do you see a lot of acres with irrigation?
I would say outside of the high plains, it's quite a bit less, I would say. So the high plains, probably you see a lot more irrigated acres than you do anywhere else in the state. There's some in the rolling plains, some in South Texas, very, very few in the Blackland region. The high plains really see more of the irrigated acres. Usually it's in some sort of rotation with corn. And so I think it fits more into the rotational deal than anything else. But irrigation is also becoming more of an issue in the high plains as well, with, you know, decreasing well capacity. Very few of our wheat acres are probably really a true full irrigation anymore. There's more limited or deficit irrigation now than there probably was in the past.
And you've now been, you know, working with some small grains up in Washington State as well as Texas. Do you find a lot of similarities, or are there some pretty big differences? Well, obviously the rainfall, I'm sure, is a big difference, right? But I'm thinking more toward like management practices. between the two locations that you've had, you know, some pretty good experiences in?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, wheat management is a lot more intensive in Washington than it is in Texas overall. It's mainly because, you know, a lot of our wheat here in Texas is used for forage, and, you know, people in there aren't necessarily going to want to buy certified seed just to use as a forage source. So we have, I don't know, it's got to be less than 15-20% certified seed acres for wheat in the state. In Washington, it's 98% certified seed. The growers up there, you know, wheat is king, and they're going to put the money into it, generally speaking, to get the high returns out of it. There's no forage component really into that at all. It's all for grain. So you see probably a little bit more, you definitely see a lot more certified seed usage. Probably see a little bit more fungicide usage. Their growing climate is more favorable. Each year we lose a number of locations to drought, and, you know, our dryland sites. We just this year I think we had two that we planted and they still haven't germinated. That's not something you can control. That's a pretty rare occurrence up in Washington to lose something to that. And we also lose in the springtime, we lose a number of trials to things like hail. And didn't see very much hail when I was in Washington. So some really, you know, high impressive yields when I was in Washington State, I enjoyed seeing. The first year I was there, 2020, was just a really good production year for wheat. And we were running the combine, and we have the little module on the side that's, you know, estimating grain yield. And when you're cutting dryland wheat that are yielding 165 bushels per acre with a test weight of 64, I mean, that's just, I'd never seen anything like that, you know, considering most of my experience had been in South Texas. It's just really impressive stuff seeing the yields up there.
We definitely do not get those yield levels in Iowa.
Yeah, and you know, some of our growers in the high plains, you know, they're higher elevation, they get those cooler night temperatures doing grain fill, and they still get really high test weights, and they can still, this last year we had a number of sites that we had varieties in the 120s and stuff, so they do good and stuff. But seeing, like I said, seeing dry land wheat yields that were over 150, I saw it a couple times when I was up there, and that's just some impressive work. So
you're expanding your variety trials in and trying to understand a little bit more on the dual purpose production systems. Do you have other areas that you're looking to maybe move into in the coming years?
Well, I think another big aspect of my program is really rust management. We're kind of at the forefront of rust in the U.S. or for, you know, the Great Plains especially. And so there's a lot of opportunity there as far as I probably myself need to be a little bit more involved or vocal in trying to get the word out when we, you know, are seeing a lot of rust developing in the state. Because 2 years ago, you know, it was some of the worst stripe rust that we had ever seen in the state. And that went up into Oklahoma and farther than that. Last year was a really quiet year for rust. This year, I've been trying to, you know, talk to people, as, you know, and let the word know that we're seeing a lot of leaf rust this year, very early on. And so I think we get some more rain coming this weekend. We're having temperatures in the mid 80s in February. There's a high potential for a big leaf rust pressure year this year. And so I think a lot of another opportunity my program has is really working in rust management, both from the survey, trying to, you know, get the word out that it could be a bad year for rust. So be ready, you know, be prepared, be scouting for that. You know, fungicide efficacy is another big thing. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in that. We have one site down south of, or right near San Antonio, our Castroville location. And I've seen wheat plants there that have leaf, stripe, and stem rust on them at the same time. And so we have a favorable climate for rust production. So there's some opportunities there as well for.
Yeah, I imagine the fungicide efficacy is of interest and in importance, really, you know, as you have those issues. And then really thinking about the economics behind it, especially, you know, in a maybe like a dual purpose, you know, system where you want to protect some of that grain yield potential, but yet you still want to be able to have it for the forage.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, there's two sides of that. It's the fungicides, but then the genetic resistance. And that's what is sometimes very impressive when you think about the breeding efforts, both from the private and public entities. Last year, and we're doing it again this year, we're taking all of the varieties that are being entered in our state trialing. So last year we had 64 entries. We have a little bit more than that this year. And we're planting them in single rows down at Castroville. So we can take a one environment screening and look at genetic resistance for rust, because that's a big deal. Now, I think that, you know, there's been studies that show that even if you have genetic resistance, there's still sometimes a benefit to applying a fungicide. But maybe, you know, if you have a really good rust-resistant variety, maybe that eliminates one fungicide. Maybe you only have to do one fungicide application in a season rather than two. And that can, you know, when farmers are dealing with low commodity prices like they are right now, that can maybe make the difference for them in a successful versus, you know, down year. And it's just impressive, like I said, looking at side-by-side varieties with one, you know, variety that's just 90-95% of the leaf area is covered with rust, and the other one has maybe, you know, two or three specks on it. It's just amazing to see the genetic differences there.
Yeah, that's some really big genetic differences that show up.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, Brandon, we're running close on our time here, and so I'm going to jump us over and talk. We'll really ask you the final three questions. So let's jump right in with the first one. What is your go-to agronomic resource?
Well, I would say that there's two things that I guess I'll bring up in this segment. One of them is Leighton Emke puts out the wheat varieties. I think it's for Kansas and in the Great Plains. It's pretty much a variety description book, very in depth, though it covers a lot of aspects of the different varieties that it covers. That's a great resource as far as looking at various, you know, items to for each variety, but also as kind of a guide working with Texas Wheat, the wheat board here in Texas, and trying to develop something that's similar to that for Texas, you know, specifically for Texas. So really like that as a resource and kind of a guide. The other one I would say that I was not as quick to jump on as many of the other colleagues that I work with at A&M, but that's just AI apps. Maybe from a different standpoint than what maybe others consider. But one example I'll give is just, I was working on a piece of equipment, and I'm good enough to fix some things when they're broken, but not an expert on mechanical issues. And we were working with one piece, and we accidentally broke off this little electronic part that was in the machine. Just this little blue piece that had a bunch of multicolored bands on them and stuff. And I'm like, I don't even know what this is. And so I just take out my AI app and I take a picture of it and I ask, what is this? And not only does it tell me what it is, it provides me with a place that I can order it online. And I mean, the amount of time, you know, when you talk about time management and with all the trials that we're doing, as well as everything else going on, that makes a big difference, I think. So.
Yeah, AI has come a long, long ways, and I expect it to continue to grow quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what do you do in your free time?
Well, my wife and I share a common interest in fishing. So we're located about two and a half hours from the Gulf Coast. So whenever we get the chance, we try to make it fishing down there. A lot of our vacation time, you know, she's from Washington, I'm from Maine. I've got family in Florida. She's got family in Arizona. So we got people all scattered across the U.S. So a lot of our travel time is spent traveling to see family. But usually we try to sneak some fishing in whenever, whichever direction we go to as well. So
I bet it's fun to go out on the Gulf and do a little fishing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then the last question is, where can our listeners go to learn more about your small grains variety program?
Yeah, so we have a website. It's the variety testing website. It holds all the different crops on it, but our specific one is varietytesting.tamu.edu/smallgrains. And that's going to really show everything that really my program does. So any of the varietal screenings that we do for rust is going to be listed there. All of our variety trial data from across the state is going to be listed there. Right now, we even have our field day schedule that we're working on is posted right at the top there. So if someone's interested in coming out and seeing the wheat plots, we'd love to have them there. And that schedule is being updated as I get various events in.
That sounds like a tremendous resource for growers in Texas and even, I would guess, surrounding states as there's some similar varieties that get used.
Yes. Yeah. No, we are fortunate. We work with a lot of good private and, you know, we test varieties that are grown in Colorado and Kansas and maybe even farther north than that. So it's a great opportunity to be able to work with a diverse set of genetics.
Well, Brandon, thank you for joining us today. This concludes another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. If you enjoyed today's episode, please let us know. Leave us a review. Your feedback is invaluable to us. Until next time, this is Mark Licht for the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.